Aloha and welcome, my good people. It is Wednesday, and we are all here to have a good time. Want to first just start out by saying what's up to some people in the chat. I see Shelly's here. Good to see you. And Priscilla Rose, Jay, here now, Lateral, Kabir. Who else we got? Sound off in the chat. Glad to see everybody here on time and punctual, unlike Gabriel. He'll be here later. I think maybe about 20 minutes or so is what he said. Running a little late, but I know he's got mystical adventures. So I'm really excited for a fun hang tonight with Seb. He's a newer friend of mine. We actually met about a year ago, but we kicked around the idea of doing a podcast together. I kind of lost the thread, and now it seems like the perfect time. So Seb and I, we met through him doing a Battlefield tuning with me. And I also recently got to do one for his wife. And I feel like I intimately know people after that type of experience. And anyway, Seb has got a lot of bizarre life experiences. It seems like when it rains, it pours when it comes to paranormal and fringe stuff. For some people just got the touch of the weird, and not everybody else does. I've had my own share of interesting experiences. So I know that there's a lot more possible in this imaginal realm than maybe the mainstream and normie materialist perspective would want you to believe. So Seb, how you doing, man? Thanks for coming on and hang with me tonight.
Hey, I'm terrific, Chance. Thanks so much for having me, man.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Always love it whenever we can get somebody fresh that wants, you know, that's raring to go. It's got cool stories. That's what Vibrant is really all about. So if you want, just introduce yourself and, you know, where you're at in life, how you got there, or anything you want to open up with is all good.
Sure. Yeah. My name's Seb Bland, and I live here on the Big Island. Me and my wife are just kind of getting back to the land here, and we built our house recently, and I'm a carpenter. And so just trying to get a little closer to growing our food, you know, the dream of life and stuff. We've got a young baby and life's really good. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about is out of body experiences and stuff and my journey with that. And that's kind of been happening for me. Been having them for over 20 years now. Just a lot of far out stuff to share along those lines. My guess kind of backstory with that would be that when I was about 15 years old, my grandfather, very cool guy, and he just kind of out of the blue shared with me that he had had out of body experiences, and that was like the first time I'd ever heard about that. And so it really, you know, opened my eyes at that time. And then still while I was a teenager, I found like a book or two on the subject and read up and started trying to do the practices, the kind of relaxation practices, visualization stuff to try to accomplish it. And yeah, then I'd say in my early,
what were those initial techniques? Is that something that you can maybe share with people easily. For their, yeah, like they don't necessarily easily. Need to read a book. They could start trying some stuff.
Yeah. No, I love it. And I've had many times where I've shared these kind of basic technique practices with people, explained it, and then it's happened for them. You know, I really think that it's you know, it's just simply knowing that it's possible is just step, just opens the doors and the floodgates right then and there. So the simple practices would be just deep relaxation. So what I would do a lot, I still do, is before I'm going to bed, I'll do a lot of kind of laying in bed. I'll do tensing and releasing kind of to about, you know, 25-30% muscle tension of like, say, moving through your body. So you could start with your feet, then your calves and your knee, you know, just working through your musculature system, kind of just gently tensing and releasing to get really relaxed. You can go as far with this as you want, but the ideal goal of what you'd want to accomplish is that your physical body is so relaxed that you might not even you say your hands are by your sides, but you don't even, you're not even aware that exactly where they are. You're just try to get really loose, and you're really relaxed. And then
it's like your body just feels like it's a nebulous cloud instead of a body.
Yes. Yes. And that's what you're going for. And so, and it could take quite a while, you know, but it's just that ability to enter into like the, where you would be going to sleep, that kind of level of bodily relaxation while you're still conscious. And from there you can, start to notice maybe some energetic, buzzing or vibrational feeling, frequency feelings, and you're moving through your body. It's also a lot of practice where you're trying to get lucid in your dreaming state so that you're aware that you're dreaming. So there's things, tricks you can do, like say build a habit, like 10 times a day. If you look at your watch, you just go, am I asleep? Am I awake? Am I asleep? You know, just something to build a habit. Then maybe in your dream state, you can start to have that habit built in of questioning whether you're awake or not. And so things like that, you know, there's a lot of books on the subject that have, you know, somewhat similar things that they say. For me, most times, leaving my body, I will wake up at night and then, be from kind of a lucid dream and then be able to, leave my body.
So what's the, so after the deep relaxation, are you like letting yourself go to sleep from there, but attempting to stay lucid in the dream, or is there a exit strategy for getting out of the body? I've done it, but only kind of spontaneously and accidentally.
Yeah. The exit strategy is just when you start to feel a vibrational frequency in your body, you start to feel like, you're slipping out of your body. You can be like floating almost. You're like, whoa, you can feel like you're almost flipping upside down or something. And that's kind of where you're getting loose from your body and you're coming out of it. And the number one thing is just to just stay really relaxed and not get too excited, you know, because if you get excited, that's going to kind of strengthen it's going to wake up your body kind of. So it's just the whole trick to it is just staying really relaxed through the process of getting out of your body.
Yeah. That vibrational frequency, the way it feels to me is like getting plugged in, like a power cord getting plugged in at the base of my neck. And it's intense. There's like literally an electricity up and down my spine. That it is a vibration. Yeah. I guess when you're getting electrocuted, you are getting vibrated. And it feels like that. There are times where that freaked me out and I would fight it, but my body would be in that asleep state or relaxed state where I was like kind of paralyzed and I was like, what's going on?
Yeah. The sleep paralysis is that kind of sleep paralysis is a big one. People will fight it. And so if you fight it, then you'll just wake up and be able to move your body. But a lot of times, you know, there's sleep paralysis that is perfectly fine and there's nothing wrong with it. It's just you're loose from your body and you need to kind of relax into that to be able to get out, you know.
The first time I got out, I was in that state and I'd been there a couple of times before, a little freaked out, fought it and got myself able to move again and basically pulled myself out of it. And then one time, this female voice that I have no idea who it was, but like a straight up voice started giving me instructions like telepathically, but it was like I could hear it, but it wasn't audible. I don't know how else to describe it. And I have no idea who it was or where it came from, but essentially got the message of go with the flow, just go with it.
Yeah.
There's something to see here. And then that going with the flow is what sort of popped me out instead of fighting it. So going with the flow is essentially relaxing.
It's the only way. Yeah. Just relaxation is the whole entire key to the whole thing is just relaxing and going with it. And it can be intense, you know, different times it'll be different. Like there've been times where the vibrational frequency gets so intense that it's literally sounds and feels like jet engines. And it's like your chakras are like jet engines almost. And it reaches this really high pitched crescendo. And then boom, like you blast out of your body, like at a million miles an hour. And that's happened to me a few times, but that's not the more common one is where I just kind of start floating out and get out.
So you think when people are falling asleep and they do this like whole body jerk when they cross the threshold into sleep, that's maybe them leaving their body. But the difference being when you see that or when you do that, it's typically you're like unconscious when it happens. So the practice here is staying completely aware and mentally awake while you go through that transition experience, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And and it's just a practice, you know. Just it took quite a while before it started working for me. And then it didn't really start working in the sense that I could just lay down and make it happen. It would be more that I would do the practice, go to sleep, and then in the middle of the night, I would wake up and be loose from my body. So, you know, it just, I feel like there's an enormous amount of kind of like divine meaning like your spiritual guides and stuff. There's like a lot of kind of assistance that you get that I've gotten in my experiences, right? So, you know, it does feel like I get some help in doing it. Like,
yeah, I had a voice just tell me. I had a voice come and help me one time. Only happened once, but it was really distinct and clear. And I have no idea where it came from.
Yeah. So even when I get out of my body, I still kind of go with the flow in the sense that I'm looking for guidance. You know, and that can be kind of like just something like a spiritual guide kind of, you know, showing me a direction to go or literally bringing me to a place where then the, you know, experiences continue. So some of the first out of body experiences I had, I went kind of up into the spirit world, and there's different realm levels of the spirit world. So, you know, some that are just very, very beautiful, and the only people there are just like ultra enlightened. And one of my first experiences that was the first place that I went, and just got, I think, the most profound healing of my life was in that experience with this really big, well, almost like 10 foot tall woman, kind of Polynesian looking woman in a green robe. And she just brought me into this place, this kind of temple place where she was, and just kind of picked me up and held me like a baby. And I just, you know, just cried in her arms, and it was a really powerful experience. And
basically our baby to a 10-foot tall woman.
Yes. Yeah. Giant Polynesian looking woman. Right. And so then I go through different levels of the spirit world, see different things. There's definitely like kind of lower levels of the spirit world, I think, where a lot of people who have passed on are playing out karma, or there's like kind of weird things. It's like wishy-washy vibes. Like they, it's hard to explain, but even like the landscape in those realms of the spirit world can change really fast. I think there's been some movies that have done a good example of showing this. I think there was like a What Dreams May Come with Robin Williams, where his wife dies and he goes into somehow ends up in the spirit world trying to save her. But it kind of shows that where like the landscape can change kind of quickly, you know? And I think that's kind of a good example of kind of the kind of lower levels of the spirit world. So, I've also, you know, gone to places in the spirit world where it's like a big house, right? And it's a big party. There's just like tons of people there. And it's a welcome home party for someone who had just passed on in the physical world and they're entering the spirit world. So all their friends and family and everybody's there, you know? And I mean, that's just like the most love and ever, you know, just the most awesomest party you could ever imagine, you know?
Interesting what you're saying about the, even calling things higher or lower is weird, but there are realms that are created in our almost like they're like psychic realms that we create for ourselves, that they actually exist before we die. But I think that there's like a fragmentation of our spirit or our consciousness that can occur in life and does occur a lot. Tuning is something that can help with that, or shamanic soul retrieval, where certain like traumatic experiences or a lot of like self-directed malice energy from regret or from guilt and things of that nature can sort of create these inner realms where a version of yourself, a schismed, broken off piece of your overall ego consciousness, can continue to exist in almost a time loop of a place and time that reflects where this schisming happened. So whether it's like replaying a certain amount of time in life or a very specific moment in life, I think that what goes on is after someone deceases, but they've got all this fragmentation, the parts that aren't the main self, they can continue to have these, they can continue to exist in their own little like psychic bubble, and they can be encountered even by people exploring, I don't know, astral realms or whatever you want to call it. I used to be a bit of like a music festival psychonaut in my 20s. Mm-hmm. While everyone else was like partying and the mind altering, consciousness expanding substances were somehow a party for them. Like, I tried to make it a party, like everybody else.
It's never a party for me. It always gets way too real. And I don't understand how people can not see everything. Oh,
I know. Yeah. Like I would just be interacting with these soul fragments or lost souls or whatever you want to call it. I would have to like sit down and the night would be over. Everyone's going back to their tents, and I go back in my tent and close my eyes. And now I got to interact with like a line of spirits that are aware that I can perceive them, and they want my help with something. It's so weird.
Yeah, but I know. I'm right there with you on that. Yeah, it's a trip.
Yeah, it's hard, maybe a little hard to describe, but they're all like these, maybe we could call them ghosts. I don't know exactly. I'm not claiming to know, but I think that they're not exactly I don't think that people leave behind a ghost when they die necessarily, but I think that there's like fragments of their spirit that can get left behind. And that's what we encounter. Maybe sometimes a full on, will not go on because of one problem or another or being tricked or duped.
So on that note, I've had some experiences. Like one comes to mind really clearly where one of my spiritual guides brought me when I was out of my, I left my body, and he brought me to this place. It was like a park, like a city park kind of place. And there was, and he pointed out this guy in there who was, deceased, you know, passed on spirit. He's in his spirit form, but he was haunting this area. And he had had addiction issues when he died. And so he was kind of stuck and there. And so my spiritual guide basically just gave me the cliff notes on the situation and was like, go try to help him out, you know? So I sent me in there to talk to him. And I did, I tried. I don't think I was very successful. I think the guy was just kind of too scared. And, you know, I just think, hey, that's how it is, you know, whether you're alive in this, in living physical world, or you're passed on in the spirit world, we still have free will. And so people can kind of like run from help as long as they want, you know? And so that is, that's kind of how we end up having ghosts haunting an area. A lot of times it's they're doing that because they're just in trauma, you know?
Yeah. And then the thing with the addiction mentality is that, and this doesn't even always like apply to addiction, at the root of most all problems, I keep coming back to to new insights and realizations about how blaming externals, blaming others is the root of all illness and problems on some level, yeah, in some respect. And that's also the trickiest thing to help somebody out of, because the last thing that usually works when somebody's in the blame state is to tell them, hey, stop blaming. You're actually just blaming.
Yeah.
There's a valid perspective that they are in where they've identified with victimhood in some way. And, you know, you can't really shake somebody out of that. The best you can do is help them sort of work around the edges of it till they see it for themselves. And I think that applies to spirits. You know, when I've encountered what you call more like demonic attachment entities in people, and this comes up every once in a while in tuning, although I don't really want it to, or I try to avoid it if possible.
Yeah.
But every once in a while it'll come up in tuning, and the thing that gets the full portion of the ego identity stuck as like a hungry ghost, wandering spirit in this realm without passing on is typically a fear and a blaming of the source or of God or however you want to describe it, that if they go there, they'll be punished or they'll be disintegrated or cease to exist, something like that.
Yeah.
And what I think goes on, I want to know your take on this, is I think that there's just like an as above, so below deal. I think there's a hierarchy of the hungry ghost, you know, deceased human entities. Actually, the word demon comes from a Greek word, demonia, not the same as daimon, that means deceased human spirit.
Yeah.
It's like, I think that that's always been the case. I don't think that there were just, you know, infernal evil spirits created for the purpose of tormenting us. I think it's generations of unsent spirits, but I do think that they have like a hierarchy on the other side where some are aware of the con that's being run. And I think they hang out around hospitals, wait for scared people to leave their body, tell them whatever they need to tell them to like recruit them. It's basically, hey, don't go into the light. That's not going to be good for you. You've been really naughty, so it's going to disintegrate you. You're going to cease to exist. So they operate under orders to mess with humans, to harvest energy through influencing. So, you know, it's always just influence. It's never control, but through influencing self-inflicted suffering, essentially. But most of the time, other than some exceptions where it's intentional, these demonic spirits, as in deceased humans that are lost, they're doing it out of a fear that if they don't, that it's the only thing that they can do to continue existing. And the irony is they're keeping themselves out of the reincarnation wheel or moving on to whatever's next, if not a human incarnation.
Yeah, it's just an egoic fear of change and, you know, sensing that something would bring great change and, you
which
know,
would just be to face the light and see their self for what they are in the full 360. Yeah,
to go with, there's a lot of work that is done in the spirit world where just spiritual guides or people, just people like you or I or any of our friends, if we were in the spirit world at this time, one thing we might be doing is going and trying to help, kind of like a social worker, trying to help these earthbound, we could call them like earthbound spirits, to get to try to convince them to, hey, come on, come with me, you know, just leave this. You're not getting anywhere down here. Just come on. Because
you know what really works?
If they could come up into the spirit world, there's just so much more vast resources within the spirit world. People can literally be taking classes. There's constant room for growth that can take place in the spirit world, you know?
I found a pretty surefire method of speaking to these things, if you ever encounter them in some way, that basically it came through my learning about like what is what are the names of God actually mean? Particularly like the Tetragrammaton is an example. It means Yad He Vav He. It means existence or life. And also pondering Abraxas, which is the power or effectiveness that transcends all duality, opposites, and their nullification of themselves, because effectiveness or existence cannot be nullified by non-effectiveness or non-existence.
Exactly. So,
with knowing that the source or the creator or the, you know, the prime mover that initiates all things, the effect, the thing, that the cause of all effects is existence and life itself in the purest form with no duality negations, then what the opposite of that would be, like the head of the demon corp, the word Satan or Shaitan, it means opposer or adversary. But like, what's the opposite of existence is non-existence. So it's sort of like one of those, you know,
what is the opposite of power? Powerlessness? You know, it's exactly what you're saying. It's not like there is a existent duality of like that has like equal power in the sense, you know, there's no duality. There's of like that is like equal in power in any way.
It's like a mafia operation where all of the middle managers are acting like they're following the orders of some top boss, but you go up to the top floor of the tower and there's nobody there or the guy's dead or something, you know, it's like a fake boss. 'Cause that's basically what the adversary or opposer to God or source would be, is non-existence. So I always just tell the demonic spirit that, hey, the thing that you're afraid of is non-existence, and the thing you're serving is non-existence. And if you just turn that around, you can exist again. 'Cause as of right now, you're just a figment of my imagination. So, you know, if you want to stay that way,
I think the best way I could put it is, can you hear me okay?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Oh, hey, brought Gabe in. Right. What's up, man? Aloha.
Much love and respect, buddy. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. So, just to say this one thought on that, what you were just saying there, Chance, is I think that the best word for it, as far as what is it in the lower planes of the spirit world and in this world, dominating this world, this physical world, at least within the mainstream realms of it, the word is fraudulence. You know, that's all it is. It's just straight up fraudulence. We have a bunch of frauds making false claims, and
that's why I liken it to a demonic corporation in the spirit world, because
where there's no one there in the top floor. Yeah, it's fiction. It's all fiction.
So Gabe, how you doing, man? We're talking about getting out of the body and encountering hungry ghosts and all that fun stuff.
Excellent. Excellent. Yes, I'm doing quite nice. The spring is really on. I'm feeling the urgency of things to do. There is so much this time around. We are really blessed to have a gorgeous spring ahead of us. I'm looking so forward to it. And you know, you said it's a fraud. That's actually a section in Dante's Inferno. In the Divine Comedy, there's a section of hell that's actually, it's called non-hell. So it's like kind of automatically speaking in the negative. It's like, so you're already in the negative. So everything on the other side in non-hell is an opposite world. And that is where small fraud takes place. And it's like a side door jurisdiction of the infernal zone. And it is, it's an exception to the order. Like he's like, you know, the first layer, the second layer, the sixth, seventh. And then all of a sudden he takes a detour into this side door reality of small fraud. And then he comes back to the order and finishes it off. But somewhere in the mix there, there's this like, side door jurisdiction of everything here is like the disclosure to how the court procedures actually operate. So yeah, I think there's a lot of terms of the condition in Dante's Inferno.
Yeah. So as I was saying, how we kind of got to this place in the conversation is that I was explaining some out of body experiences I've had, you know, over a long period of time. And some of them, I have gone to those kinds of places in the spirit world where, for example, here's a great example, right? Is I'm in this place in the spirit world and I'm invited into this house to share a meal with these people. They're like, no, come in, you know? And so I sit down at this table with them and, you know, there's some, I don't even remember what the food was or anything, but I'm just kind of like sitting and observing. And some people get up and leave, some other people come and sit down, and then they literally are trying to charge me. They're trying to like charge me money for this, whatever. And I haven't even accepted anything. And so I was just like, this is absurd, you know? And I got up and left. And as I explained, you know, and I went outside, the landscape had changed since I went in. And so it's a really good example of kind of that, that side door, as you're saying, that lower realms, you know? Now, to tie back into what you were saying, Chance, about there not being a power that like opposes the light or the goodness of life, that's really what I learned in having these out-of-body experiences, is that I did have encounters with very lecherous spirits, very dark, lecherous spirits, and that was very scary for me at first. But what I learned very quickly was that all I had to do was literally call on the assistance of my spiritual guides, and any of that oogie stuff would just be just literally vaporized from my presence and instantly. And I've kind of compared that to being like, if you're a WWF guys in a WWF style, right? And the guy's getting his ass kicked. He's just got to tap in his dude in his corner, right? Tap him in. And I think that because like the laws of the universe are so perfectly clear in honoring free will, you know, the lower beings and all that, they if they're incarnated here, they'll rape someone. If they're in the spirit world, they'll do that same kind of transgression of just like, try to spiritually rape someone, try to objectify people. And so they're not honoring the universal laws of free will, but all higher power beings do. And so you just have to ask them for help and they'll help like as soon as you can make the thought of asking for help. And right, so
the hermetic principle, I don't remember which one it is in order, but basically that there's not actually... You know, there's not really opposites. There's just degrees of something. So in terms of light and darkness, for example, or heat and cold, there is no cold and there is no darkness. There's just the absence of light or the absence of heat. So it's just it's only light and the matter of degree of how much light is there. So you encounter something that's like fronting that it's all dark, that you just call in some light and light always wins, like, because the dark isn't even there.
The shadow can, there a million pounds of shadow can't fight against a single candle flame. You know, it's like,
exactly.
It's just, get in a giant stadium and put one candle in the middle and the light will touch everywhere. You know, it's just.
And people really should think about that. That's beyond just going in weird inner world experiences or out of body experiences and things you might run into. I'm saying that's like, that should be your life philosophy. Keep that in your pocket.
It should be meditated on.
Especially remember it when you're in a state of fear, something scary happening. Just remember like, oh, if I call in light, if I be the light right now, there's nothing to fear. And it's all, it's all love. And if I'm feeling scared, then that just means I need to bring some more love in. There's because the opposite doesn't exist.
Exactly. And I mean, I've manifested that understanding and that power through me in many situations in my physical life, you know, when I've been up against major injustice, from like a whole bunch of Border Patrol cops just being assholes and trying to psycho attack my girlfriend. Like when we're just we're completely innocent of any and all crime, and they're just bored, you know, and they just, she's pretty, and so they're just doing some psycho shit, you know. And it's just like you manifest that power of truth, and then everyone is just shrivels, all bullshit shrivels up in the light of it, you know, and people just tuck tail and run.
You know, I'm thinking about Carl Jung wrote a famous letter, and I'm going to screw up this quote really bad, but he wrote a famous letter to the founding figure of Alcoholics Anonymous. I forget that guy's name, Bill Wilson, maybe. And in the letter, he tells Bill Wilson this Greek maxim that I'm totally going to screw up the maxim. I encourage people to find their own receipts on this, but the maxim is essentially advice that it's composed of: find the greater spirit to overcome the minor spirits. And that's an oversimplification of what he gave to him. And so we are the greater spirits, and we must embody that in the moment when these little piddly little minor spirits come around. And that includes jokers in costumes are totally included in that.
Exactly.
Something that I do in fear. Yeah, buddy. Something I do in fearful situations. I heard a Christian today. He was like, when you do the Lord's Prayer, I think you should do the movements and the bowing and actually get down. He's like, because that brings the body into the ritual. And I'm like, dude, you are underselling your potential. You're underselling it. Just bowing and doing this and calling that getting your body into it. I'm like, this guy needs to hang out with me. Because I have entire dance routines, dance movements, and songs that I sing to change the whole vibe of my space. So yeah, the cross and the prayers, like, that's all good, but I like dance moves and songs too.
All right, we got to pivot. Juan is here, and he needs to know about big feet. Can we get into that, Seb?
Bigfoot.
Well, he said he's here for the big feet, but I think he means, you know, Bigfoot plural, potentially.
Yeah. He wants to hear about the Sasquatch.
I do.
Yeah.
I put it in the description.
Yeah, great. Okay, so let's do it. I've had many encounters with Sasquatch in physical and one in my out-of-body state. And They started coming around me when I developed a very keen interest in them. And I was living in the Pacific Northwest, kind of out in the country. And so I was really, like I said, I had a very keen interest, and I'd heard a lot of encounter stories from people that I knew who I fully trusted, fully believed them. So, I didn't have any doubt in my mind that they're real, that they're out there, and also that they're more spiritually advanced, you know, spiritually aware, psychic, telepathic, and all that. I had one come right behind my cabin that I was living in, and he woke me up in the middle of the night and did the telepathic, you know, speaking into my mind, just saying, here I am, like in a sense of meaning, you've been wondering about me, so here I am. And he did that in conjunction with his voice. So his voice was like, ooh, you know, and it's like the sound of like a 1,000-pound being, you know, so it's huge sound. I started going out in the woods camping, seeking that out and bringing them food and stuff. And, so I got surrounded by them all night long, always really positive experiences, no fear whatsoever. Felt very welcomed and really cool stuff. My out of body experience that I had, this is about, I'd say about 6 years ago. My stepfather had passed away pretty recently, and we were very close. And so one night I wake up middle of the night and I'm loose from my body. So I just relax and I go with it and I get out kind of upside down floating and I get out of my body, kind of get regain control. And I get out of the cabin. I'm outside under a beautiful starry night. And I'm just, what I normally do in these things is I'm just like, okay, where am I going to go? This is great. What, give me a sign, show me what to do, you know, where to go. And up walks my stepfather who, and you know, when he passed, he's in his like late 60s and he's overweight and everything. But as he shows up now, and this is extremely common with meetings in the spirit world, he is in his prime form, man. He is just tall and thin and looking beautiful. And he shows up and I'm just like, oh my God, we're both so, so happy. We immediately just start wrestling and we're just like wrestling and hugging and like just laughing and crying. And so we kind of conclude our meeting with each other. He's like, he tells me he's got to go. So he goes and it's just, I'm overjoyed. And I go, it's kind of the sun's coming up and I go cruising off kind of through the woods and I get, I'm just kind of looking, just a beautiful night. And when you're out of your body, you can move pretty quickly, you know, almost like run flying kind of experience. So I get out to this big field at dawn and these, and I see three Sasquatch on the other side of the field. And so I call out to them and I'm like, hey, you know, cause I'm thinking, hey, I'm out of my body. I can actually, maybe I could meet them. Right. And they look at me and then they kind of turn their back and they're just kind of blowing me off kind of vibe that I get from them. And then I call out again and I kind of get down to my knees and I'm like pleading with them, like, please, you know? And so then they turn, they come back to me, they walk across the field right to me. And then there was, so there were all three of them were male Sasquatches, but the one of them was the elder. And you could tell he's just obviously bigger, older looking. And he, they all come right up to me and he basically just communicates to me super clearly that he's like, you need to understand this. He goes, we are in no way evil. We are just very upset with what humanity is doing to this natural world. And I was like, oh, okay, got it, you know? And it was very, I mean, their presence is super fucking intimidating. It is really just abrasive, rough, like 8-9 foot tall. They're just enormous. There's like, yeah, very, very little can describe like how big they are when you're right in front of them and how powerful their energy is. So yeah, that was my one like face-to-face communicative meeting that I've had with them out of the body.
PK wanted to know if in the chat, he notices that people who have Sasquatch experiences never call them Bigfoot. And he wants to know if Bigfoot is the N word to Sasquatch.
I don't know. I don't know, nor do I care. I call him a Bigfoot. It's cool. You know, I typically call him Sasquatch because I just think that's the more appropriate or whatever. But
squatching.
Yeah.
I have a, you know, what I think about it is because it seems like there's just so many stories and experiences. I've been a listener to Mysterious Universe podcast for over a decade. So I've heard every Bigfoot Sasquatch story probably that's ever been published. They scour the internet for it. Some of them are really silly, but others really like get you scratching your head. It seems like there's something to it. The consistency between people's reports and those of the experiencers that seemingly had no interest in it. And then it just fell in their lap and it was something they had to deal with and talk about. So I don't know exactly what's going on, but what it makes me think of is long time ago, I did some shows with Mitch, the organ donor, not that long ago, a couple of years ago. And he was depositing hundreds of pounds of organite around Arizona.
I love that guy. I've heard him many times. He's just the best, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And he really did a lot. Since then, I have developed a lot further in my energetic sensitivity and have been able to, at least to my own subjective satisfaction, prove to myself that there is an energy field around organite. That's a real thing. I can feel it. I feel it the same way as I feel human energy fields when I'm doing tuning. So I know there's something to it. And when Mitch put all this organite around Arizona, not only did the monsoon season end up being the biggest rainy season in like a pretty dang long time in Arizona, but also there were some animals and other like insects and things like that that came back into the environment sort of all of a sudden, not just one, but a few. And that makes me think, you know, back to the whole existence versus non-existence question. When I really take that philosophy to the nth degree, I have to apply it to the question of destroying the environment and extinction events and all that. And so my current, this is just my belief, not maybe provable, but my current understanding of life is that nothing is ever lost and nothing is ever non-existent. And if we are experiencing a world where there's less biodiversity and fewer types of creatures and variety of them, it may just be that our perception has been further and further filtered and narrowed into a shorter bandwidth of what life actually is. And so what we see of life is just the not, I almost said bland, no offense, that's your last name.
Oh, it's
a more
great.
Bland kind of nature where there's less there. And if the frequency bandwidth is part of what, like our perception of and our immersion in a frequency bandwidth potentially is even being restricted by all the EMF full spectrum dominance going on. If changing that and healing the frequency environment, as Mitch seemingly did in Arizona or improved it, also results in more in creatures that were thought to not even exist anymore showing up again, then that tells me maybe that's what's going on with Sasquatch, that Sasquatch has always been here, but it's outside of most people's frequency, perception, bandwidth, range, whatever you want, however you want to describe that. And then nothing's ever extinct. It goes extinct in our mind. you know, we filter it out completely and we lose it. But I don't think it's ever actually lost from reality. And as you're somebody that's done a lot of a wider spectrum consciousness practice on purpose and intentionally, kind of doesn't surprise me that you'd be out in the woods and you'd actually seem to run into or have experiences with creatures that are more mythical to the average person.
Yeah.
Does that all make sense?
Also, yeah, totally. 100%. And, you know, not just the Sasquatch too. Also, the Menahuni, which are the little people, they're like elves. So when I was a little kid growing up here in Hawaii, I was probably about 5 years old and I was playing on our property and I just playing around in the dirt and I looked up and I was surrounded by probably about seven of these little guys. And it was super terrifying to me. And for them, it was, I could tell like it was a fun game for them. Like they had me surrounded kind of like a Red Rover situation. I had to literally run right through because they're like, you know, I'm 5 years old and they're like half my size, right? And so, it was a very scary thing. And it was made worse when I tried to explain what happened to my parents and they're just like, nah, like they didn't believe it. They just telling me you're fine. No, whatever. And, later in life, now that I've had a lot of out of body experiences, I've had at least one or two, I'd say two experiences, out of body experiences, where I'm literally out of my body and I just sit down with one of these elf beings, these little guys, little people, and have a long conversation. And that is very cool. The the one, the most informative one was, I'm sitting with this little elf guy, and he's quite old looking. And I asked him in our conversation, I asked him how old he was, and he said he was over 700 years old. And so I was like, wow. And he just knew everything about everything. I knew everything about humanity and history and all the truth about everything. And so there was a lot that we were talking about. A lot of it, it's hard for me to remember, like, details. I remember a vibe of conversation, and I remember that a lot was shared, but it's hard to bring it all back.
You know? I get it. Yeah. And it's more like an energetic transmission that our mind interprets or dresses up in the form of a conversation, but it's not the same as
conversation in the sense that, like, I remember some questions that I asked, and I remember his whole demeanor about his response, you know. Like, I remember asking him, I was like, you are so wise, you know all this stuff. I was like, are all of your kind, like, I asked him, are you like exceptional among your own kind? And he said, not at all. He goes, we're all like this, you know. So really cool stuff, you know. But yeah, it is a conversation, though. It's just like that, the facial expressions, the demeanor, the self-expression, the way in which a person does that. It is this beautiful conversation, you know?
Let's get
Gabe ahead, in here. Go ahead. Go please.
Okay. All right. So I'm kind of a nerd for patterning. And a lot of times when I bring these patterns forward, I just want to be clear that I'm not saying that these are man-made constructs. I'm saying these are pointing at a greater truth, that our words are just enough to indicate a general direction to look at. Chance and I talk about this a lot. The best we can do is describe the finger pointing in the general direction of truth sometimes. Our words fall short, you know, but
yeah.
I want to offer up some of the gems I've picked up in my path on in terms of the Sasquatch and the Bigfoot, mythologically speaking. One of which is that at the end of the story of Solomon, when Solomon is taming the demons, at the very end of the story, they actually leave you guessing as to whether Solomon vanquished Asmodeus, or did Asmodeus switch Solomon out. And now when you follow the Solomonic path, you're actually being misled by Asmodeus because there was a switcheroo. They do the same thing in the devil. In the Bible, at the very end, you're like, was that Jesus or was that the Antichrist? Which was which? And they just leave you to guess. It's like, it's on you. But anyway, Solomon, at the end of the story, he spends the rest of his days with an enlarged foot. He has one overgrown foot. He is the original Bigfoot. Yeah. And he hides it. He's constantly obfuscating or disguising his foot so people won't see it or think badly of him. So this is the club foot. And this card, the Empress card, she's hiding her feet. She's got some weird, maybe mermaid feet going on. There's some mutation or something going on. And she's a female. But she is in a direct alignment with Asmodeus in the infernal realms. This has much to do with Raphael, the angel who tamed Asmodeus. And so the relationship of this card is in direct contravention against lust. And the cure against Asmodeus, strangely enough, is cooking some fish liver to make Asmodeus leave. And that casts him out. So the fish liver is part of the Enoch Book of Tobit. But this card is basically encapsulating a lot of what Solomon knows about fighting off demons. But then I also got to say, Chance, we're always about out of buotes. This is an out of buotes experience. This is also the Bigfoot of the Fool Card initiation status. This little gap right here is the Buotes constellation. And the Buotes are also the poets, the inspired ones. And in order to be inspired and convey messages from the other side, like you are, you have to get out of your own way. You have to roll the stone out from the cave, and you have to remove your own ego to let this knowledge come through you. And that is the great void of Buotes. And so to have an out of Buotes experience is to leave the ego behind and go into an objective worldview and move around and bring back all kinds of beautiful poets.
I want to riff on that, Gabe. I really like how you put that. And I think that there's something there that we could flesh out a little more for people, because beyond just fully popping out of your body and you're floating around the room and looking down and seeing your body, there's also shamanic techniques of getting into trance with drum and rattle, or just listening to drum and rattle. You don't have to actually be playing it yourself. This was my first foray into these type of things. And man, I still remember the first time I did it. I think I was like 23 or something. And I laid down on the floor listening to this drum and rattle track. I got my body fully to that state we talked about at the very beginning, where it feels like a cloud and a nebulous cloud instead of a body, but I'm awake. And then at that point, you've got your eyes closed and you do some visualizations. Like a common one would be to find a tree, or maybe you could find a ladder in your mind's eye. And you, depending on which way you want to go, either go down into the ground below the tree and into its roots and picture or visualize yourself going down. And that's not like taking you to hell or anything. It just takes you to a more like going down takes you to a more like animal type world, a more natural world. That's the direction you go if you wanted to meet animal totems or animal guides. That's actually what I did on this one. Or if you go up the trunk of the tree or up the ladder visually, you are able to potentially meet more angelic beings, or go to like cityscapes, or things like Seb talked about meeting the 10-foot-tall Polynesian woman who rockabye babied him, stuff like mm-hmm. that. So my first time though, I wanted to meet an animal totem. So I visualized going to this tree, and this part of the practice, you're kind of controlling the visualization. You're intending to have a certain visualization, but eventually as you're going down, it will start to take on its own, it'll animate itself. And this is where you know you're in the zone. So I know that I physically can still feel my body. It just feels cloud-like. And I know the room I'm in, the drum and rattle track is still going on, but I going down under the ground through the roots. And then I come out and I'm in this field of tall grass. And at this point, this is where the trick that you're describing comes into play. Because now I'm no longer trying to control the vision. I'm no longer trying to intentionally find a tree and go down into the roots. Now I'm just observing what's there. And the trick to getting a good, to communicating with things or finding a guide or having a shamanic journey is that at that point, you have to really surf the line between witnessing and paying attention and understanding what you're seeing, but not interpreting it. And not intending or controlling. So that is the fine line that takes potentially practice, but you can feel yourself just like on a surfboard or something. You can feel yourself leaning too far into the like unconscious witness where you might start to even fall asleep, or leaning too far into the trying to control the vision and losing it. You know, you'll lose it if you try to control it. It'll just vanish and then you'll be just laying in your room again. So my first time ever doing this, I feel myself going through this tall grass, and I'm cutting a tunnel through this tall grass, not cutting, but like, you know, walking a path through it. And eventually I find that a monkey pops out. I'm like, is this monkey my spirit guide? You can ask questions when you're there, because I wanted to know what's my totem animal. What's my, you know, what is that? And I got the impression that this monkey was not my animal totem, but that I was meant to follow it. So I follow it. We're going through the grass, and we come out on a beach, and there's the ocean in front of us. And the monkey basically insinuates that, like, I'm supposed to go out into the water. And it's not like, you know, real life. I don't feel water on my skin or anything, but I know I'm going into the water and then I kind of submerge into it. And then a shark comes and the shark comes out of nowhere. And I'm like, okay, I know I'm safe. I know there's nothing dangerous about this, but the shark came at me all menacing and shark-like. It was a big ass, like great white mega shark. And in the vision, it rips me to pieces. Like, I see my arm fly off. I see a foot, you know, I'm torn to shreds until I'm just sort of like a floating orb of consciousness. And I already didn't have a body. So it's kind of bizarre and paradoxical, but I just knew that I was being torn up. And then I watched the pieces of the body go back to the shore, like, you know, drift back to the shore as the tide takes them in with the waves. And then the monkey is there again on the shore and he brings body parts back to me where my frame of reference is at and starts reattaching them, but also attaching parts of tiger essence. So in the like shamanic vision, I get torn apart and put back together. Yes, there's the tiger on the full card. And I get put back together with like, I'm like a human tiger hybrid. Awesome. And it's been a while since I really did shamanic journey work. But from that point on, when I go into the like lower world part, the animal world part of the shamanic journey, I would have this tiger body. It'd be a humanoid body, but I'd have like orange fur with black stripes on parts of my arms. And, I, you know, there's more to it. But anyway, I also got other information while I was there from another entity that I met that sort of gave me answers to questions. Essentially, I wanted to know, should I drive to St. Louis tonight and try to meet up with this girl that I was talking to? Like, or is that a big waste of time? And I basically got like the thumbs up that if I go, there would be big spiritual benefit to me taking this spontaneous trip to St. Louis. And I did go to meet that girl, but before I ended up meeting up with her, I synchronistically ran into another recent friend acquaintance, and he let me crash at his place for the night. I had no idea what I was getting into. I just drove up there and I was like, "It's going to see what happens." And the next morning after I crashed with this new friend, he took me to a sweat lodge. That's a whole story in of itself of crazy, some spirit interactions actually that happened during the sweat. And I could go on and on, but like, that's the type of thing. I don't know that I feel like the shamanic journey work technique, it initiates a synchronicity storm. Sometimes if you do it, and sometimes you might do it and it's just like, oh, that was kind of neat. That was cool. No big deal. And it doesn't feel like much change, but sometimes you do it and it opens the door or it reflects in the external world with some big transformative life experiences. Like the girl that I ran into that I ended up dating for several years, and it was kind of a big life path step and all that. And even though that relationship didn't work out, that I matured through that relationship in ways that was really helpful for me. So that's my story that was sparked off by what you're saying of, you know, letting go of the ego, because you want to be there. You're witnessing the vision, but you're not holding on to it. You're not controlling it. You're just walking that fine line right in the middle. And I recommend people look up like drum and rattle shamanic journey tracks, maybe do like just a little bit of reading about what you're supposed to try to do in that experience. Could take you somewhere, you know, especially if meditation isn't quite for you. This technique is a little more active and you can set yourself up for what you want to experience and then be surprised by what comes out of it. And it's really amazing.
Nice. This kind of sparked some thoughts in me. Just try to flow with it here. One thing with like, so having these shamanic visions, it's really not that different from a dream, you know, and, you know, we all to varying degrees have dreams. And I dream a lot. always have. And it's I think it's really important for people to recognize and clarify for themselves that dreaming is like really powerful, and seeking to kind of wake up within your dream world to have lucid dreaming is just a really good path. It's totally how this, it is the step for step kind of way that I've gotten into having out of body experiences. And also things can come through in dreams that are very similar to an out of body experience in the sense that, like, you know, I'll have spiritual guides show up in dreams, and I didn't leave my body. It wasn't a time when I actually woke up and left my body, but that same spiritual guide that I've met with out of my body and full on out of body experiences can later in a different time just show up in a dream and sit down and talk with me and tell me some stuff. And boom, it was just, to my knowledge, it was just a dream. But there's really not, I mean, they're both in the similar territory, right? Though both of those experiences are happening in a similar territory of our consciousness being like basically outside of our body while our body's sleeping. You know, I think that's a lot of what dreaming is.
So what do you think about spirit guides in terms of their existence outside of the mind or imagination of the person or they're guiding? I wonder, I mean, I don't necessarily
they are a living entity, a living soul, just like you or I.
Do you think there can be exceptions to that where there's almost like a more egregoric type of guide? I ask this because I have gone on spirit guide discovery shamanic journeys before to look for a spirit guide and wound up talking to Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. And it was, you know, completely real in the reality of how any other like totem animal guide experience was and whatnot. But this is also a fictional character. So I wonder about that. I also sometimes have living people show up to be my spirit guides. So I honestly use Gabe as a spirit guide all the time when I'm dealing with difficult spirit attachments in sessions. Gabe comes through. Yeah.
So I think that they can also try to change their appearance so that, you know, it might have been an actual spiritual guide just kind of appearing to you as Gandalf. Like I'll give a brief example. So there's one of my spiritual guides who's a very powerful, like master type being. And when I say that, I mean, like, some of these people, their love is so powerful. Their presence is so like nourishing and healing and just, and you just, when you're in their presence, you know, absolutely know that you can ask them anything and they'll know the truth. They'll know the answer. They'll give it to you straight. Right. And so one of these masters that I met with way back when I was first really I wanted to meet my spirit guides. Right. So I was seeking out a body experience. I was requesting that. I was literally like praying for that, you know, and so my first encounter with them was this. It was a dream and I'm being chased by a rhinoceros and I'm running. And so I run into this house. It blasts through the wall. I run into the kitchen. It blasts through the wall. Everywhere I go, it comes just charging straight through the wall. Right. So I get back to the door. I go out. I run outside. I'm running down the street. And it blasts out of there. It's chasing me down the street. And all of a sudden, I just go, wait a minute. And I stop running and I turn around and it stops. And I see that it's actually not a real rhinoceros. There's like a guy inside of it, right? Like operating it or just, it's not a real rhinoceros. And the guy steps out. And he walks up to me just like literally like, good job, you know, like I passed the test. And he comes up and he kind of gives me a little like some love and a, you know, pat on the back and kind of tells me this little joke. So it's just like any of these experiences of meeting with one of these type of level caliber of guides, it's like meeting your real dad or something. I mean, it's so powerful in that.
I think all the boogeymen are a dude in a suit or like a guide in a suit. I mean that even in like
I think
people that are doing evil and perpetrating on the world right now, I think a lot of them are incarnate to do that role, even though it's hard. Then you have to drop down spiritual levels to do it and, you know, go through suffering yourself to inflict the suffering. But looking at indigenous cultures and their initiation practices and how weak our initiation practices are in the Western cultures, I think that a lot of the societal friction and degradation we're seeing is just almost antibodies or something to help us self-initiate into what we're here to do and why, like what life is supposed to be about or get into harmony with life. And I ultimately back to that question of the light and the dark and all that. I think that although it can appear that there's good and evil, and of course there's behaviors that we would consider evil or aberrant because they're antithetical to life, all of it serves good and growth in the end. So in the end, it's all good. And that's helpful to get past fear too. Gabe, I want to ask you about something though, because we're talking about dreams and here, and by the way, the Ace Ventura dude in the rhino suit dream is awesome. Thank you for sharing that.
I have another thing on that.
You go for that. And then I'll remember what I was going to ask Gabe. Go for it.
Okay. What I wanted to say about it is, okay, so that was my first meeting with that guide. Right. And then years later, I had another one where I left my body and I get out of the house and I kind of looking for where to go. And I see a light going across the sky, which looks just like, you know, these high up, like a spaceship, you know, it's kind of floats like a feather. It's a bright light, brighter than the stars in the sky and lower in the atmosphere. And I've seen these so many times in my everyday, you know, looking at the stars at night. And so anyways, so I'm out of my body and I see that and I immediately am like, I can go there. I'm out of my body, so I can go there, right? So I just call out like, hey, take me up, right? And I immediately start going up towards it really fast. And I'm looking up in the sky, going up to it. It's getting closer, closer. Boom, I pop right up into it. And now I'm in this big room that's very like comfortable room, kind of almost like a carpeted type floor. There's like probably 10 people sitting on the floor in front of this one guy who's that guy, that same guy from the dream years ago. And he's sitting in a chair in front of people and he just tells me like telepathically, basically just sit down and observe. So I do. And he's giving counsel, giving guidance to all these people sitting there, kind of going through them and talking to them individually. And I understood what was going on. Naturally, I understood that what was happening was a lot of these people were out of their body. Their physical bodies are in bed asleep and they're out of their body, but a lot of them won't remember this tomorrow. Or maybe they'll think it was a dream or something or remember a bit or a piece of it, but they weren't the same as me. Like they weren't consciously out of their body at that time. And I could kind of just understand that. And so, for example, there was these two girls that he was talking to, and he was explaining to them that they were going to meet for the first time in this lifetime. They were going to meet very soon. And that their friendship would be lifelong and be like the greatest support and strength for each other, you know, but he was just kind of giving them this update on their situation, that what was coming around the corner, you know? And really cool shit. But it was the same guy, you know, as from that dream years earlier.
It sounds very like Daemon, as in the guide. There was a good THC episode that just came out where Carl Wood was talking to a dude about shamanic initiations and indigenous cultures and all that, and how there's a widespread belief in a lot of civilizations that we have a soul contract that we come in for, and that we have a guardian angel or daemon that helps us, nudges us along the path towards that soul contract, and that disease and illness and, you know, getting closer to death, the decay aspects of life, are really a symptom of not fulfilling your soul contract. And that there's entire shamanic practices that revolve not around trying to treat the symptoms, but by trying to help you figure out what your contract is that you're not living up to. And contract even is a tough word, but it's like your purpose. And if you're not living up to why you wanted to come here in the first place, then of course it makes sense that your soul would start to evacuate the body, and the body would begin to break down because it's, you know, it doesn't have any purpose. But yeah, Gabe, you got something. Popcorn Gabe.
Yeah, buddy. Disease. Tizadi. The Tizadi is the fish hook. The Tizadi is the desires. The desires. Too much desires, unsatisfied, leads to disease. This Tizadi, this fish hook, is really versatile. It's even hanging out in the word authenticity. It's so fun. The Tizadi of the desires. I want to get a couple hanging chads from things we've said here. I want to mention that Gandalf is encoding battle wolf chants. The name Gandalf means battle wolf. And Castillo de Gandolfo is a Jesuit stronghold library where the Voynich manuscripts were stored for a long time. And the name of that library led me on a wolf trail that I learned that Gandalf means battle wolf. So there was your animus. And then you can see it. The word master is a loose anagram for treams. Treams. And when I was young, I went out west looking for a master to fulfill my dreams. And so I think that's very fun that we take counsel in these wizened elders who we find on the other side. And if we're lucky, we can remember the story to bring it back to share with other people. And then Seb, the rhino having a reoccurrence later in another dream, but being the same character. That is so profound. I want to mention there's a theme of gray. The wolf is gray. Gandalf is gray. The rhino is gray. These wizened elders of ours are Gray Maw and Gray Paw. These are the ancestors talking to us. The grand elders
are
generally gray with wisdom. And then to plug Jim Carrey in there, just for a second, I want to fulfill the potential of Jim Carrey, because his name encodes Jaimes Carrey. If you say it with that Latin spin, it's Jaimes Carrey, and it becomes I am scary. And that over actor is very scary in a lot of ways. But Jaimes Carrey, Jaime is also brother. James means brother. This is the card for twins, for Gemini. This is number 6 on the Enneagram. It's a loyalist with a shadow of fear. And so Jaime Scary came to visit you dressed in gray and tested your resolve, right? He was acting as scary. And then you passed the test and you took off the mask, or he took off the mask. But your courage, which is the remedial virtue of number 6, your courage met him at an even keel to unmask the Jaime Scary from your dream. That's really fun.
I love it. Love it. Yeah. Let me riff on something here. And I said to get into this. So one of your last episodes, you were talking about the love it so funny. Babe, I'm stolen. Oh yeah, my son has come to bring me my hat. He thinks I need it very much.
Good man.
Thank you.
Oh, you didn't
have there we go.
Naughty stuff you're doing in here.
Okay, honey. This is my boy.
Perfect.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
Say hi. Can you wave?
No.
Yeah. Hi, guys.
Beautiful child.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Well done.
I thought it was
almost done.
What a beaut.
Love you, honey. Love you. Thank you. I love you.
Okay, we're gonna
really soon.
We like families around here. We're pro family, so it's good to see a happy baby.
Yeah. Okay. So jumping into this thought here. Recently, one of your last episodes, you were talking with a guy, and you guys were talking about the Holy Grail. Yeah. So the Holy Grail, as you guys were hitting on, is actually a stone. It is a crystal. And I have a lot of kind of awareness of this fact from, it's a big story, but I'll try to condense it. So in Tibet, it is referred to as the Stone of Chittamani. And it is spoken of that it exists within the hidden kingdom, often called Shambhala. In Tibet, they were well aware of this. So I found out about this from becoming aware of Nicholas Roerich, who was back at the early 1900s. He was from Russia. He was a painter. He's very esoteric. Him and his wife were both very esoteric people. They started the Agni Yoga Society. They were very influential. They got the Pax Cultura, which is a basic worldwide treaty that war any places of cultural and artistic significance would be protected during war times. They pushed that through somehow. They weren't like wealthy at all. They didn't come from wealth or anything. But their family, and I'll tell you how I got a segue for a moment to say how I know this. So one of my very first meetings with one of my guides was extremely powerful and very, very healing for me. And he came to me and in this kind of out of body experience, and he gave to me this book that said Agni Yoga on it, A-G-N-I Yoga. It's a little blue book. And he gave it to me and he just hugged me. And I cried so much in that embrace that when I woke up, my physical body had been crying too. And I'm like, my whole pillow was wet. It was just insane. And so I thought that book, I was like, I must have that book. You know, I had a bit of a library. I was always picking up books back when I was 18, 19 years old, you know? So I didn't have that book. I really thought that I had it. I didn't have it. And so then fast forward a few months later, and I knew nothing of Agni Yoga or anything. I'm in some random bookstore in Seattle, Washington. It's a spiritual quest books. It's where they have the Theosophical Society there. And I just would do this thing where I close my eyes, I walk down an aisle, and I just grab a book off a shelf. I did that. I grabbed that book off the shelf. It's extremely rare book. Extremely rare. to ever find it in a bookstore, and boom, that was it. I found it. And so then I was like, I was blown away. I mean, well, this was one of the most significant things that ever happened to me at that time in my life. So I did more research into like, what is this? This is back before the internet was like barely anything, right? So it took a while, but eventually I found out, okay, this is Nicholas Roerich. I found out about that. I got more books by them. And since then, yeah, I've had memories come back. I've had things happen where I know that I was a part of that family. I'm not going to get into like exactly who or anything, but it was a family that did this together. And they, so anyways, I do believe that I was involved with that, in my past lifetime. Anyways, so now I'll fast forward. So what they did was they traveled into the Himalayas as a family in like 1920s, I'm going to guess, right around maybe 1915. But they traveled all through the Himalayas for like over a year on this expedition. And they got funded to do it by, I think, the agricultural, like head of agriculture here in the United States gave them government money to do it. I'm blanking on his name, but he later became, I think, vice president. And he had written a lot of letters with Roerich, Nicholas Roerich, that were later called like the guru letters. He was kind of like chastised publicly for this, ridiculed publicly. But anyways, so he put up the money for them to do this expedition. They went into Tibet and literally went to Shambhala. This is my opinion based off all the reading and everything that I've done in the subject. They went there and they brought back the Stone of Chittimani, which is the Holy Grail. And if you look at Roerich paintings, you'll see a lot of his paintings. He's holding this box. And that is what was inside of the box was the Holy Grail. It was brought out of Shambhala down, and he brought it to, at that time, the League of Nations was happening at that time. And he brought it to them as a gift to bless their ideal of what they were trying to do. And then later, when it wasn't going with its intention, it was getting corrupted, he took it back. And so a very interesting shit in all that.
He's an Indian giver. You know, because the whole Chittimani thing is a Sanskrit concept.
Chittimani.
Yeah. It can be Chittimani, Chittimani, Chittimani. There's like different pronunciations, but just to break down that word, let me get an image of like they depict this. It's similar to when you see like Mary holding an egg, for example, or in Renaissance art, you know, you see a lot of holding of an egg. This is Lakshmi, who is, a Hindu version of Mary, essentially, same concept. Yeah. And this stone, the Chittimani, as the Holy Grail, I really like that weave there. I'm taking note of that because I definitely see the correlation. So Chitta or Chinta means love, and Mani is the protagonos, the firstborn of the first cause, basically the Adam character, Noah character, the reincarnating being that comes back in a cyclical way to help the world re-enlighten itself when necessary. So Buddha type guy, essentially. So it's the love of Mani, or the love of Adam, or love of Noah, love of Jesus. And that's interesting because when you look at it that way, this Sintamani is basically divine love. And when you consider the name of like the title of Christ and how similar that word is to crystal, it's the stone of that, you know, Christ is the stone of divine love as well. The rock yeah. upon which the church is founded and all of yeah. that. I believe this, there's mythology of this Grail stone thing also related to Indra, and that it felt like, you know, they have stories of it actually being a real artifact that fell from the heavens to earth and things of that nature. You know,
yeah. And that's what, that is what they say in the Tibetan explanation of it. And that it is a larger stone, that the Grail then would be just a piece of it.
So as its power is described as, at least in the Hindu tradition, described as being able to fulfill wishes. And my take on that allegory is that if you have the Sintamani, the love of Christ within you, then you're also going to find your wishes fulfilled. So basically, like, you know what's right. You know the right way to behave. You are aligned with the good and with the life principle. Then you basically are given blessings and allowed to have good things in your life that you wish for, that are aligned with your soul purpose. And then part of the other part of the mythology is that if you possessed this stone, but you were evil in some way, then it would bring terrible misfortune upon you instead of fulfilling wishes. And I think that's also part of the truth of how natural law works, is that when you're nescient of right and wrong, then behaving in ways against the natural law or wrong ways, the consequences aren't going to be as harsh. But when you do, when you're willfully ignorant of right and wrong and you do evil anyway, then you get a real kick in the ass. I think yeah. that's part of the lesson behind this as well. And then there's the alchemical aspect of a philosopher's stone being a part of the process where, you know, you reach the last exaltation of the material that you're working with and you have just the pure essence. So there's that as well. Gabe, get in here.
Yeah, buddy. So I recently read Plato's dialogues, Socrates' dialogue with Aeon. He's a rhapsody. He's a poet. He's like a hip hop artist. And he's rhapsodies are notoriously fancy dressed. It's so fascinating how rhapsodies are basically rappers. And we've just tweaked the word a little bit. But the rhapsodies are inspired by the poets. And he describes the anatomy of inspiration. And he talks about it as a magnetic stone in the heavens, that the poet is the next ring of attachment, the original poet who wrote the works. And he's the first ring that is conveying the magnetic conveyance. That was redundant. But he's the link. And then the poet that is repeating the work is the next ring under that. But what's cool is that the original authors, they make a chain going horizontally from the magnetic stone. And they're all conveying this magnetic attraction back to the source of inspiration that is the stone. And then every little wannabe rapper who comes along to imitate the words is a link underneath those chains. And so the anatomy of inspiration is it's metal, it's an alloy, and it's allegorical. But also, I just want to convey that aspect of surrendering your weapons, like that statue. She had her one hand was facing downward. And there's an aspect of like encouragement, surrender. It's giving and taking in the same gesture. It's like giving you a pat on the back, but it's not asking you to place anything in it. It's the empty hand upside down. It's very powerful, the symbol of an inverted hand like that. But I want to mention that some of the early legends of stones that fell from the sky would have mysterious abilities, that when the night would come to the stone to harvest the alloys from heaven, the stone would steal his sword out of his hand. His sword would leap out of his hand and attach to the stone instantly. And this tells him that God is not down with war. Get your little devices of violence out of the presence of the Lord. Because the stone was magnetic. Because it's magnetic, it steals your weapon. It disarms you. So the magnetic stones are intrinsically disarming, much like benevolent sky gods.
That's freaking sweet. Seb, I wanted to ask you if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about, I know it's been a year, but sharing about getting a tuning. And because I don't know if I really heard from you much after the experience, I'd love to know if there was any interesting shifts or just what your take on the process is.
Yeah, it was great. You know, I went through massage therapy school literally like right out of high school, like at 19. I went through a year-long program for massage therapy, practiced it for years, did a lot of energy healing stuff myself. it wasn't like weird for me, right? It's like stuff I'm pretty hip to, but it was really cool. And I was... you at that time, you did also a tarot card kind of pulling along with it, which was very awesome as well. I remember that being really cool. But the experience of the tuning, it was really cool for me that I could feel in myself the areas that you were working on. I could literally feel it happening in my body as you were doing it, you know, over your like crystal setup that you have on the massage table that you have in your home there. And so, but yeah, I could feel it. And then also your keen, which I'm very curious what this experience, what this is like for you, but you were very able to tune into, like you said, like somewhere in my third eye and you're like, okay, there's some scar tissue or there's some energetic stuff to move there. And it was relative. You were able to tune in the exact time of my life and the situation kind of hints at the situation that it was involved with, which was spot on. And that just that alone was really healing for me because it was a very, very intense, hard time in my life. So in a way to just kind of be seen with that, have some, yeah, it was good. Just that alone was very good and healing. Yeah, the whole, all in all, just awesome. My wife just had a session with you and had very similar experience with kind of like where you kind of hit the nail on the head as far as a time in the life, certain years old, and what the situation was about, you know? So yeah, kudos to you. It's great stuff. I recommend anyone interested, just yeah, try to do it because it's a great service you're offering.
Thanks, man. That's exactly what I wanted you to be able to share with people because there might be somebody out there that's wondering, like, what's it really like to get a tuning? And it can be different from person to person, but there's a lot of unseen forces that come to our aid when we invoke a process like that. And then, as you said, the witness, just having some witness on something can be healing. Like I did a recent client I worked with where we did a double length tuning, like 2 hours instead of 1 hour. And that was huge because... And I think this applies like beyond just the effect of tuning forks and the way that we can help with issues in the psyche in terms of personality and expectations about life. But also sometimes it just can help where the right components of the life story are all brought out and told in the same time, like at the same time to the same person. Because, you know, we tell stories about our life here and there as a one-off, or maybe we tell a couple to somebody. But the combination of just the right stories to see the overall pattern and for all those stories to come out and be brought up to the forefront of mind at once, that alone can make a huge difference for somebody. Like, yeah. And I'm just glad we were able to have a good session, and your wife did have an awesome session. Shout out to Rachel.
Yeah. Yeah. Really cool. Really cool stuff. Yeah. So before we wind down
do you remember what tarot card?
I remember that they were perfectly, so it was like you pulled the sun card, and then
we did that after the session, right? We did a full, we did a full oracle card reading after the tuning
session. Yeah, but they were all just like perfectly, like the one is the perfect balance of the other. It was just kind of like, it was one of those where the actual odds or chances of pulling those in, it would just be so astronomical. You couldn't even.
I call it the hot hands.
Hot hands.
I've done it on live streams and we're talking about a card and I just pull it out of the deck.
Yeah. before we like,
so the sun card corresponds to the Northwest.
Oh, flesh that out, Gabe. Explain territories and what you're just saying, and then we'll pass it back to Seb. We have a little delay with Gabe. We got to work with that. It's okay, though.
Yeah. The Northwest, Washington, Oregon, that area is very much built into the sun card in my territories map. I've basically put the zodiac onto the United States. And then in all 12 stations, I fulfilled all of the major arcana onto the 12 stations. And it's a visual thing to explain. Chance had the patience to go 3 hours on the territories system with me once, and it locks. It's a really solid fit. But I think that's beautiful that you pulled the sun card, because that's basically your part of the United States in the territories map. And while I'm on the territories map, I just want to share with you that. So like up here is the sun card and also the emperor card. The emperor and the sun card are both in Aries. But what's kind of funny, I just want to point out that right about here is where Skinwalker Ranch is located. And Skinwalker Ranch is a hotbed of paranormal activity, but it's also in the butthole of the gigantic character who I've outlined. If you can see it, this is the nose of a giant sphinx hidden in the United States map. There's a sphinx character. This is the nose. It's wearing a really obnoxious headdress. These are the feet. And then this is actually its belly. And these are the 2 feet, and it, up here is the wings of a gigantic, I call it the sentinel, but it's a sphinx. And a sphinx is a chimera, and the word America is an anagram for chimera. And so the chimera of America is right here in the map, and right in its bunghole is where Skinwalker Ranch is located, the hotbed of paranormal activity. Is right here in the butt of the chimera. So I just wanted to kind of point out some of the ingredients of the territories map. But you're also in the same quadrant. You're kind of sharing that landscape with the sun.
I used to live there. I'm in Hawaii now. I'm in Hawaii. Yeah.
But you live there.
I moved to the moon card, bro.
The moon? Yeah.
You went from the sun to the moon card. Now you're in the moon card. That's great. Hawaii in reverse is Yahweh. And if you read Moses and monotheism, Yahweh might have been a volcano god. And so there's a good reason for Hawaii to be Yahweh in reverse.
Yeah.
I want to say, Gabe, about territories, because I've been meaning to ask you this in this episode. The bridge collapse thing. So I wanted you to give your take on where that lined up in the territories. And then I wanted to share back to dreams that the night the bridge collapse happened overnight. So like 1:30 a.m., maybe like something like that, you know, overnight. And while it was happening, and this bridge was over the Susquehanna River, which is a very significant river to mysticism, synchromysticism. You know, the king of the synchromystics, Michael Wan, has this whole Susquehanna alchemy project that is huge. And so the night that this bridge over the Susquehanna collapses, I was having a very vivid and lucid dream in which Michael Wan and I were playing flag football in an NFL stadium. And this, but the field was a crescent shape instead of a rectangle shape. And we all, like, there was a, it was a huge dream, but that was the basics of it. We were playing flag football in a crescent moon shaped NFL stadium. And so I was with the Susquehanna guy while the bridge was collapsing over the Susquehanna River. And it was super weird to me when I woke up and heard about that.
Wow, buddy. Wow. Okay. The flag of flag football. The football is the Aegon.
Oh, false flag.
It's false, a false flag. And the ship is literally, they describe it as, it's from Singapore, flagged Dolly. They don't say it's from Singapore, named Dolly. They describe its name as a flag Dolly. So it's not named, it's flagged as Dolly. So I sent you a couple
of graphics. The crescent shape of the field, we also know that the crescent moon shape can also occultly represent the ark or a boat. So that might be a component, yes, too, symbolically, now that I'm thinking it through.
Totally, totally.
My reading on that situation is that if something happens, like on a large scale like that, just black magic. Sick.
Most F.
There's like, yeah, no other.
they never would waste a chance to harness an opportunity to traumatize us. You're totally
on right. An equinox.
And an eclipse.
Equinox. Yeah. Yes. Totally. Yes. So Pontifex Maximus is the bridge builder, the boss of bridges. He's like the Jeff Bridges of the spiritual realm. Hefe Pope Bridges is encoding the Pontifex Maximus. Yep. So we're going right through the equinox line. Actually, Chance, can you do the other one, the one with the Godzilla first? So I had just done an episode about the Hermit card as it relates to Panama Canal over on Third Eye Edify with our buddy George Mesa. And that was a great episode. So the Hermit card was fresh on my mind, as the Hermit card is the primary depiction of a boat. Of all the tarot cards, of all the minor deacons of the Zodiac, the Argo is the boat. And it's depicted on this Hermit card. And what's amazing is the word Baltimore in reverse is Eromit Lab. And the Hermit card has his dogs, his Labradors, his three-headed Cerberus right next to him. And so there's a boat. Even the
okay, just to back up, Eromit is a type of Labrador retriever. I just had to Google it. I've never heard of that. Just so everyone's...
Oh my God, I did not know that. That's fascinating.
There's such a thing as an Eromit Lab.
It's the word hermit, basically.
Whoa.
That's a trip. I did not know that. So I'm putting a silent H in front of Eromit, and it becomes hermit, basically. And then he has his Labrador next to him. Even the mangled metal of the bridge resembles the white hair on this tongue. Now, this is the card of Virgo. The Hermit card is correspondent to Virgo. We are in Maryland, between Virginia and Maryland. So the Virginia is the Virgo. Maryland is the whore who is lubricious. She is Libra. She's going to be more scales of justice and the Wheel of Fortune card. And this is a very unfortunate event. But just notice that the map of the entire Chesapeake, the Delaware, the Chesapeake, even the Susquehanna, when you look at it from a 40,000 foot view, it is a perfect profile of Godzilla. Even when you zoom in close at the details of the map, the spines of Godzilla are undeniable. There are the spines of Godzilla exactly as it's designed in Hollywood. He even has claws. He even has the long tail. So the entire map of this body of water is revealing the Godzilla. And this is just so rewarding because our buddy George and I, we were dealing with the idea of giants of industry leaving destruction in their wake. This is the Eldritch plan. The word Eldritch means the old ones. It means macabre, scary things, trauma ritual. But I want to bring something else into the picture that definitely is not going to come on anybody else's radar. The word Singapore is whispering the flagella, that's it, the flagella, the whip of the Opus Dei. And the zealots of the Opus Dei, they self-flagellate, they hit themselves with the whip. So Singapore is whispering the sting of the rope. And this is an Opus Dei climb. They're zapping me. I'm getting zapped. I'm starting to believe that the Opus Dei, for one, essentially, okay, they have instilled their fetish of agony into everybody. We all love our pain in our own special way. And I think to a large degree, this trauma ritual is just another flatulation. We're whipping ourselves. And it's almost as though the social engineers are telling you, why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? As we pick up these trauma rituals.
It's the initiation rituals. I think it's the, the necessary manifestation of hardship to initiate certain people who will be initiated by it.
Yep. And potentially, Chance, this is way off the deep end, but let's go there. What if the Opus Dei expects to be reincarnated in an unsuspecting soul who, when the trauma wakes up their past life programming from when they were an Opus Dei in a past life, the signs and symbols in the headlines are part of bringing out your Opus Dei love of agony. I'm just saying, I see more Opus Dei the more I learn about them in myself. I'm like actively exercising, like casting out my own inner Opus Dei. And so I want to read Carl Jung's poem on the Brocken Spectre one more time. And I want everybody to think of this poem he's being chased by a dark shadow and he's expecting it to come up behind him any moment. Kind of like your rhino. You know, your rhino was like your own self-torture, breaking through many layers of your safety, your sense of safety. I want to read Carl Jung's poem, and let's listen to this poem with the potential that Carl Jung was Opus Dei. That Carl Jung was accessing ecstatic states of communing with the other side by harnessing pain intentionally. And part of the reason I'm saying this is because we know he slept with a pistol under his pillow. We know that he had a sadistic bend to a lot of his success. And so I just want to read this poem as though it were from an communing with their dark depths. The poem goes, I had my hands cupped around a tiny light, which threatened to go out at any moment. Everything depended on my keeping this little light alive. Suddenly, I had the feeling that something was coming up behind me. I looked back and saw a gigantic black figure below me, but at the same moment I was conscious, in spite of my terror, that I might keep my little light going through night and wind, regardless of all dangers. I think it's fascinating to go back through Carl Jung's work with the possibility that he was Opus Dei, and maybe even reincarnated Opus Dei, second, third generation, epigenetic sleeper cell Opus Dei. It's pretty profound to think of. And then his comment on his own poem: when I awoke, I realized at once that the figure was a specter of the Brocken, my own shadow on the swirling mists, brought into being by the little light I was carrying. I knew, too, that this little light was my consciousness, the only light I have. And so that poem for me ties into that hermit card, because he's carrying the lantern, and the lantern has many other meanings other than just a lantern.
Interesting.
Was that a good breakdown?
Yeah.
Schizophrenic.
All over the map.
Yeah, buddy. Oh, you know, I got one more thing.
People that aren't aware of Opus Dei, it's like a Catholic subgroup, like a subsect within Catholicism, and they have been caught doing self-mortification type stuff, like self-inflicted harm. And so that's a real thing. They're like the hardcore of the hardcore Catholics, and also movers and shakers within Catholicism. You can think of it like not exactly a secret society, but a club within the Catholic faith where they're trying to set each other up for bigger levels of success and things like that, but also doing this weird self-mortification thing.
I'm assuming we're running on
I forget what it's called, but they have a strange device.
I'm kind of guessing that I can't hear you there. If you were still talking, I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah, we're winding down.
We're running on borrowed time.
There's no time limit though.
Yeah. I would like to kind of wrap up my own thoughts here. It would just take a minute. As far as like Opus Dei and stuff, I guess in a lot of like my experiences with out of body and stuff, you know, like I've met with, I don't know if you're familiar with who Paramahansa Yogananda is. Paramahansa Yogananda. He wrote Autobiography of a Yogi.
Oh, okay. I've heard of that.
Yeah. Very amazing being. He brought a lot of, Eastern meditation, Kriya Yoga, he brought to the West. I met with him. I met with some of the masters talked about in the Theosophical Society, specifically like they talked about Kutumi Lal Singh. They talked about El Moria and a few beings that they talked about. I've met with them. I've met with others that don't have a name that's well known. Master Chi-Chi is kind of Hispanic guy, really amazing. But all of these kind of experiences of getting into the spirit world and stuff, it's so, like I said before, it's so awesome in the sense that it's like meeting real peers, someone you really actually look up to, you know, really like you can sense and know that they're just like kind of all knowing and is a profoundly loving. And so I look at that stuff. I don't really dive. I ponder the darkness of like things like Opus Dei or like the Illuminati. I always ponder that stuff. It's interesting. I kind of think I know what they're doing, but it's not that high. Like it's not that profound, you know, it's just kind of corrupt and but it's not like, it's not really powerful. And so like these other beings that I've met with many, many times, there's like real power. There's like real beauty and really like, that's the mindset. Those are the, like when we were like that, when we were tuned up to that level, that's how the, that's when the pyramids were built. That's when all these great epochs and golden ages of humanity have happened. That's our true past. That's our true, that's who we all really are. And so I look at that and I don't really look too deep into too much else. And so I just kind of want to hash that thought out. And I also wanted to just throw out there quickly, as far as for people who are interested in having out of body experiences and really seeking that out, what one thing that, you know, really helped me to accomplish that, that I haven't mentioned so far, was that I got into understanding about healing and health. And I got into realizing how important diet was with that, and also fasting. And so like in my early 20s, I started practicing fasting, 3-day fasts, week long fasts, doing it right, doing it, learning, reading up on the subject, following good guidance. And that I feel is really how I was able to get to being able to do this and get familiarized with it. Because, just our physical bodies really, you can try to just relax. You can try to just go do a relaxation exercise, but you're not going to have very good results. As nearly, you're going to have 10 times better results if you do a 3-day fast. And then, and maybe do
my first time coming out of the body, I was on a juice cleanse where I was only doing like certain fruit juices or vegetable broth. I think I was on like the fifth day of it. And that's the first time I had a full out of body experience.
See, bingo, right there confirms exactly what I'm saying, is that you cannot, your energetic body cannot get loose from your physical body because it's like statically uncomfortable, because we're just constantly eating, and it just like there's, our body needs that time to process and to be able to relax. So, I mean, I've done meditation, I've done Kriya yoga. I lived at one of those centers for a while. I did all the meditation, but none of it is as good as if you do a 3-, 4-, or 5-day fast, and then you're just effortlessly able to go into such deep, transcendent states of consciousness effortlessly, where you're not just sitting there trying or something. And
that might, you know, give someone incentive to do a cleanse, maybe like, hey, you can pair it with doing some practices.
If I'm just saying, I have to talk about that, because if someone really is interested in pursuing this path of trying to accomplish this for themselves, that's absolutely essential in my experience, is to incorporate that into it, as well as things that some people might not like. But like, if you're not dreaming, well, if you're smoking weed, maybe that's why you're not dreaming. You know, you're gonna, if you want to pursue a kind of a, this path of getting to where you're not only dreaming, but lucid dreaming, and then popping out of that and then being able to leave your body. If you want to be able to do that, probably got to quit smoking weed, you know? Because in my experience, that's, you know, they just too, one thing doesn't fit well with the other. And you know, it's just, it's a great thing, you know, I love talking about these experiences. I appreciate the time given. And also I want to say, if anyone wants to talk with me about it more or has questions, they can always reach out to me. And the best, best way they could do that is just through Instagram, is really the best way to I don't have a big web presence. So my Instagram is Sebtastic, Sebtastic. And, you can find me there. I do a lot of stand-up comedy too, so there's a lot of that posted on there. You can check out. It's fun stuff. But yeah, just want to throw those things out there. And if anyone has any questions, just please don't hesitate to ask.
Cool, man. I think we gave a really good overview of how to start playing around with a further level of existence. And why it's important is because I personally have suspicions. And after talking to Mark English earlier this year, he really confirmed some of these suspicions that spiritual immortality, or the real full redemption path in life, if you will, like to, as in keep your identity alive in some respect after your physical body dies, it probably has something to do with this type of practice where you can have some experience holding your focus and attention outside of your body, so that at the time that you transition out of it permanently, you retain, you know, because your memories are your energy field, and it's a coherence thing. So like for me, going out of body would always end with me eventually going unconscious and then waking up later. And I think the ultimate attainment would be to be able to hold your attention, to be present in an unceasing way permanently forever, and no longer need the body as the anchor that keeps bringing your attention back to wakefulness. I think the body is like training wheels for infinite eternal attentiveness, which is basically infinite eternal spiritual energy and life.
Yeah, and just feeling connected and loved, and knowing that you're not alone. I mean, the psychological benefit for me is so enormous, in that with these meetings with my spiritual guides, meeting with deceased relatives and friends, which has been many that people that I've known in this life that have passed away that I've met with, and getting to see them again, just how much closure that produces, and how little fear I have of like ever losing anyone eternally, or losing or dying or any of that stuff. Is I don't have the traumatic fear that a lot of people do anymore. I don't have it. Like just recently, a really good friend of mine, he died really tragically. And it was really tragic because it didn't make sense. I'm going to break this down really fast. So he OD'd on something that he thought was a pain pill because he has a bad back. He thought it was a pain pill. It was fentanyl. It killed him. He was dead for 15, 20 minutes. They brought him back to life. And the doctors were like, he's going to have severe brain damage. And I talked to him right after that. He goes, oh, the doctor said I was going to have severe brain damage, man, but I'm fine. And I'm like, great, dude. I'm so glad to hear that. That's really, he's got a family. I'm really close with his kids and his wife. And then a few months later, he blows his brains out with a gun. Makes no sense. No sense at all. He would never do that. He's a very strong man. He would never do that. He would never leave his family. I knew this ain't right. And I mean, I just knew that, and it was so fucked up. And anyways, really fucked up. And just a month and a half ago, he came to me. I was kind of out of my body, and he came to me, and we met and we talked. And we got to clear it all up. I asked him what happened. And he explained to me that after that first time that he died, when he came back, he said it was like wires were crossed and he kind of had dementia. Like he was making the kinds of choices that someone with dementia makes. Like it makes no sense. They just all of a sudden think something and they can't. Wires are crossed. That's how he explained it to me. And that's why he shot himself in the head, because he didn't know what was going on. And so we got to clear that up face to face with all love, and him just looking as beautiful as ever, and explain that to me. And then he explained to me, he goes, I need you to contact my wife. I need you to tell her that I have this storage unit, and in there, is this shit she can sell to get some money to help the family. And so he told me that. So I contacted her and she didn't know of any storage unit. But then later she remembered, oh yeah, there is a storage unit that he had. She knew where the key, she found the key and knew the information on it. And so that worked out, you know, but
that's cool. Veridical information. I mean, yeah. Tough story, but it's cool.
Tough story, but I share all that. I share all that to say that the benefits of having that connection, working on that connection for yourself, that shamanic, spiritual, out of body, communicating with the other side, working on that connection for yourself in whatever means and path and practice that you do. I mean, there's great benefit, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes even just to be able to give a message to somebody that is
absolutely bereaved. Huge. Yeah.
Man, that was a killer story. Thanks for that. Really appreciate the hang tonight, Seb. It was awesome. And for the kind endorsement about biofield tuning, Gabe, we're going to wrap it up. If you want to make a comment though, you know, we can hold on for that and then we'll get out of here.
Right on. Yeah. This is a good episode. Thank you for that story. That is really something fascinating. The Enneagram recently, I did a run through on the Iliad as it relates to the Enneagram, and it's in the position of the gap from the 5 to the 4 is the moment when Odysseus is going into Hades and he's literally communing with the dead in that moment, and he has to make a sacrifice there, two sheep. And the dead are drawn into the blood. They want the blood. And so he has to draw his sword to keep them at bay because the blood is for designated one character only. And while he's keeping the shades at bay with his sword tip, his mother appears and he did not know she was dead. And this is him drawing legitimate intel of the real world from the other side. He had no way to know this. And so he's having a vision of his own mother. And he mentions the word pity multiple times. This gap is the pit. This is the pit of the Pythias. It's a very central position in the Enneagram, this transition. This is between tragedy and comedy as well. And so there's something personal and profound about the darkness of sympathizing with the other. And the fact that we're all going to Hades eventually. We have that enough in common to see eye to eye. But I think it's profound that verifiable intel from the other side, that is so, so powerful that you were able to convey a storage unit that would benefit her. That is such a great story. But I guess one last thing I want to say about the bio. I've learned that the word that we use for bio, it goes all the way back to the Greeks, and it has to do with Zeus. When he gets an order from the Fates, from the three moiré, he has to bow. And when he bows, the bow makes it official. Whatever the Fates have decided, he is consenting. He's saying, okay, it shall be done. And so his bow makes it final. But the word bow that they use for that gesture that he makes is still today the word that we use for bio. So your biology, I've recently kind of altered my relationship to the word, and I'm thinking of your biology is the modulation panel that gives you access to petition Olympus or even to lobby Mount Olympus. The Council of the Gods is actually your own endocrine system, really. But your biology is the modulation panel. This is where you can steer things and adjust, downshift, or even put it in reverse if you need to. And so I just love that the biology is like the control switch. This is the go-between. And when you go on fasting, is a great way to access, to thin out the veil at your own pace. And something that I always talk about when we mention fasting from food, I always make a point to also mention the possibility of fasting from words. And just simply going on retreat for whatever amount of time that you can and living in silence, communing with silence, and is kind of a pity of your own flavor. Everybody has their own flavor of pity. And so you go off in the woods, it takes some time, and go through the rainbow of emotions on your own, but stay silent. And oftentimes, the animals around you, the wind, will confirm your interior landscape when you thin the veil enough. And often a sacrifice, not eating food is a sacrifice, not talking is a sacrifice. So these aspects of what Odysseus was practicing is still available for all of us. So I just wanted to put that in context. Sometimes I think it's a pity that I haven't been able to go camping for 3 years. I look forward to the next time I can commune with the spirits in my own way. So yeah, I just wanted to share some of that.
Cool, man. I love the mythological pulling it around. And I had a fun time tonight, guys. Appreciate everyone that's hung out with us. We'll see you on the next one. Check the show links in the description for all the ways you can support the channel. Cash App at Slick Dissident. $ Slick Dissident. Thank you. Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Love you guys.